Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglin from the post-production studio of Rocketworks here in the heart of the Santa Monica Promenade on the second floor of the industrial warehouse beside the Sunglass Hut in
the Edward Winner Building.
Oh, the Edward Winner Building. Thank you so much. That voice, of course, is our co-host, Mr. Phil Lernes, and this is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
And however you are listening to us, whether it be on Jackalope Radio, The Cockroach.
Or
via iTunes.
iTunes could be something.
Or even if you come to our website, chillpackhollywood.com, where you can download and stream every episode we've ever done. And we even have a link there where you can subscribe via iTunes. And, of course, iTunes has the 25 most recent.
They do.
Wherever you are listening to us, even if it's around the world, the ships at sea.
Or out in space.
As we've established, of course, the demographics of our show, 56% listeners are female, 41% are male. So there are the 3% other.
Other in space.
So you're not joking.
I'm not joking.
Wherever people are listening to us, we do have a very important announcement and request,
right?
Which of course is please drop us a line at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, just so that we have an email address in case something happens within the next couple weeks where availability of this show becomes interrupted.
It could happen.
This is especially important, not if you listen to us over Jackalope or the Cockroach, but especially if you listen to us via iTunes or via our personal website.
Yes.
Because there are changes afoot and
behind the scenes on the technical end.
Yeah,
not changes with us. We're still going to be here. Our charming personalities.
We're going to be giving you
and giving you
till it hurts, really.
an hour
of free podcasty goodness
from the heart of Hollywood, which we can't say anymore.
Yeah, you can't say anymore. That would be one of the changes. We might even edit things like that out.
No, we're not.
Especially now that we are doing a first on Chill Pack Hollywood. We have done almost 200 episodes.
Wow.
Of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
That's a lot.
And many have featured interesting guests.
Many.
Some have featured not so interesting guys.
Not going to name names.
I'm not going to name names at all either. And but we're both thinking of a few.
Yes, nevertheless. But I'm not saying who.
And so for those of us who joined us most recently, for example, on The Cockroach, every few weeks we like to have a guest on the show.
That's right.
But one topic that we have never covered before, although it is a very integral part of
movie making. Yep.
And we've never done a show about sound, which is very ironic. We've done an entire audio-only conversation about pre-visualization and storyboards.
Right.
One of our best shows.
One of our best, with Robbie Cousins.
We've never discussed sound.
And why not do it now? Because didn't you just spend 2.5 weeks doing sound for our documentary, The Truth Is Out There?
Well, kind of. The mix. I mean, but the whole process, was quite a bit more detailed than just those 2.5 weeks.
Right. Which I alluded to at the top of the show, why our show sounds so amazing.
We
today.
Hope.
Well, I think it sounds, I just love the audio quality of this room itself that we're sitting in.
Just like the fact that you're actually able to kick your feet up on a couch.
I'm on a couch. Look at, there's water. This is crazy.
Anyway, we are at the Rocketworks post-production audio facility here in Santa Monica. And our guest today, Mr. Garrett Whatley.
Garrett Whatley, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello, proprietor. And artist in residence here at... Because I don't even know what... When people ask, what is your official title? What do you... I mean, not the corporate title of being perhaps, CEO or whatever of Rocketworks, but what do you say you are?
The honorary mayor of the Third Street Promenade, I think.
Well, we are with the honorary mayor.
Honorary mayor.
And one half of... the Rich and G acoustic shows that all the kids are talking about.
That's right. It's a man about town.
Perhaps we'll have time to talk about that later.
But this is a post-production sound house we're in. Isn't that right?
That is correct.
And you tell people, hey, I'm the post-production sound guy.
Yeah. That's what's on the card.
Really?
No, what would you...
Well, I'm a supervising sound editor and a re-recording mixer.
Okay.
Those are the two main things that I do. I also enjoy recording the ADR for actors when they come in to replace lines. If I have control over that, have better control of it over the mix, so I can mix it in better.
Well,
we'll
want to talk about all the different components that go into the sound in a finished motion picture.
Now let's dumb it down a bit.
Well, let's start with, you know, the Oscar nominations just came out.
Yes.
And I think one of the questions certainly I had when I was a kid.
Sure.
And I think a lot of people have whenever they're watching the Academy Awards or when they read these nominations. Two awards. Nominations for sound editing.
Sound editing.
Mm-hmm. And sound mixing.
Right.
Those are two different...
I think people might be confused about what those are.
Well, I think the people voting on it are probably a little confused.
And I don't think it's helped at all. That confusion has helped at all by the fact that it wasn't that long ago when, you know, I remember this clearly, when the awards were Best Achievement in Sound, and then another award called Sound Effects Editing. Best Achievement in Sound, right. sound effects Editing. Well, at least sound effects editing seemed very specific, but it also seemed like a really small, narrow thing to be giving an award for, especially in comparison to Best Achievement in Sound. Would that be one sound? Or would that be the sound?
Explosion.
I love that sound you have. It has gotten into my ear and I can't get it
out. Whenever that Paramount logo comes on, I just love how it's...
You get an award.
So what is an easy way for people to understand what it means when they hear the award for Best Sound Editing and Best Sound Mixing?
Yeah, there's probably no easy way, but I can give it a shot.
Okay, go.
Well, that's been your Chill Pack.
Yes, there's no easy way.
Thanks for playing. You know, like sound effects editing would be the effects themselves in the film. All right, in other words, if we look at the whole thing and you break it down, when you have the mix for a movie, that's taking all of the elements together and mixing them. The music, the dialogue, the sound effects.
Although, when you see the credit for sound mixer,
yes,
isn't that often the on-set sound recordist?
That is correct, yeah.
In the old days, I think it was called a sound recordist, and now it's called a sound mixer. Right.
I like to throw it back. I still call them pictures, too. So
we're making pictures, mister! Listen.
But when it's for the sound mix, does the... And usually the on-set sound recordist, sound mixer gets mentioned in one of these categories. Mm-hmm. Which one would that person get mentioned in? Would it be in the mix, or it would? I would think it would be in the mix and not in the editing.
The
for sound for the awards
for the on-set guy. Yeah.
Oh, the on-set guy. Well, I'm not sure. There's he might be included. You know, a lot of times now, especially in the larger films, you know, you'll have a sound designer who's also involved somehow in the editorial of the film. But it's mostly post. You know.
Right,
right.
That
on-set guy's not important anymore?
Yeah, no, he's history.
Is that right?
Well, I mean,
no, of course
it depends.
Not.
It depends on the film, of course.
Yeah,
but
he's part of the team.
Yeah.
When people see a big-budget action film, let's say, with lots of explosions, and a fair percentage of the dialogue, even on screen, is created in post, correct?
Replaced. Yeah.
You dubbed in left.
ADR, as we mentioned before.
Right. Automatic digital.
That is so close. Originally, I think it's automated dialogue replacement.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Now, I thought it was analog dialogue replacement.
Oh.
But that wouldn't make sense since there wasn't digital. So why would they have to specify it as analog?
Analog digital recording.
So let's start. Now, there might be a post-production, or there might be a sound designer on a film, but yes. let's say that there isn't, and let's start with the production elements. What are the major concerns when recording sound in a production that on-set person and his team should be
worried about
or making sure that they capture?
Well, I think the most obvious is the location itself and, you know, the noises. Well, you've made several of these pictures in the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this one a documentary, so it's a little different. You have no control over that element of a plane flying overhead. Or the freeway is right next to where you're shooting, and it's supposed to be a 17th century epic drama period piece.
Although I did tell Dean that it was an epic drama.
Yeah, I was told. Didn't you see my ruffles?
Yeah,
that wardrobe.
That tiny velvet cape starting to make a little sense.
Now
I thought you were just eccentric from the known gunman days.
You would think so, right? That's what I tell people now.
But, you know, the main thing, of course, obviously, is noise. And then outside of that, you got, you know, microphone placement you know, the boom operator, whether or not you're going to be using lavalier mics, the little lapel mics that people call lavaliers. You want to capture sound from as many sources as you can. And thankfully,
you're not just trying to get dialogue. You also want to record the background space itself. Right. Right?
Yeah, you want to do that separately, really. You want to capture dialogue as noise-free as possible. In fact, if you're in a bouncy room, unless you really are in love with the sound of it, you're going to want to try to minimize it as much as possible with sound blankets, you know, minimize the bounce.
And that's why they always tell me to shut up on set for 30 seconds for room noise, right? Because in the recording...
No, in your case, they tell you to shut up for other reasons.
Yeah. Oh. Have you noticed that the camera and the sound guys haven't even shown up
yet? Yeah, that's right. Shut up. 30 seconds of room noise, Mr. Hagelin. But we're not recording. Just we're doing 30 seconds of room noise.
Practice. Rehearse. Can you rehearse that 30 seconds?
Have you ever played the quiet game, Mr. Hagelin?
Now I learned.
You know, you
are we there yet?
As an aside, and we've never talked about this, but you know, we all worked on a film together before The Truth Is Out There, which of course was Spectres.
Yes.
I watched that this past weekend.
Oh, you did?
With three teenagers, teenage boys, and they all loved your performance in particular. They didn't know that we worked together or whatever.
Fantastic.
And they all said, oh, he's really good. You know, and they loved the tone that you struck with the character or whatever. But we watched the behind-the-scenes documentary.
Oh, no.
And I had forgotten that you had developed this reputation on the set of needing, like, 70 takes. And it had become this running joke. It had become this running joke. But I even do admit at one point in the audio commentary, yes, we also listen to the audio commentary, that it was never your fault. It was just like you were always the guy who was Johnny on the spot when something would go wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It all collapsed around me.
In reality, though, of course, you are the guy that needs 70 takes to get the 30 seconds of quiet.
That's right. That's where I really worked hard.
A fair bit of ADR on that, if I remember correctly.
Right. Well, I think that's probably when the two of you met.
That's where I first came into this lovely studio.
I might have gone by the old offices out in Hollywood at one point.
Maybe.
No, I think I was here.
So when someone when people are recording, when they're recording their projects, what's the best bit of advice that you can give
to
aspiring filmmakers or even filmmakers? Because sound is always a challenge, no matter how many movies you've made.
Well, I think the smartest people that have looked ahead, as far as independent filmmakers that I've dealt with, are the ones who have called me before they start shooting and ask my advice on, do you have any names of sound recordists or sound mixers?
Right. Wow, so you got a list of favorites.
Well, you know, I have a list of competents, you know, and, you know, I can't
You have a list of incompetents, too?
I destroyed that. No.
And them.
And
their careers
rest
are over.
But, you know, I inherit all this stuff. All the sound mistakes, everything that's happened on set, I've had to try to correct them. You know, it's harder in a documentary, like The Truth Is Out There.
Was there audio mistakes?
Well, not audio
in
mistakes,
a documentary, the good news is there are no mistakes.
Yeah,
right.
There's no such thing.
Right.
It's an actual document.
bad news is.
The bad news is it can be really, really shitty to listen to. Yeah. Really uncomfortable.
Yeah. We actually did a little ADR on this show.
Top secret.
Oh, should I not say that?
Yeah. Well,
but that was not
my third grade
purely actually because of an audio problem.
Well, yeah, that's true.
No, that,
that was both. Yeah, vocabulary.
Grade, yeah, my
sorry,
third grade
I
teacher.
Forgot myself.
But this is the interesting thing, especially about a documentary. You know, we had purchased this HD camera, traveled to Oakland to do tests because, as with any bit of equipment, you know, you got to put
learn
it through its paces. In order to, and you really have to try to use it the way you're going to use it. Mm-hmm. That's the best way both to test it out and check it out, but also to learn it.
Yes.
And so, you know, literally it was out of the box. I open the camera, I open the box, take the camera out, you know,
put it
in the battery, turn it on, record Dean. We know that none of this stuff that we're doing on that trip is for the film. It's just for tests.
Yeah.
Naturally, the very first thing we shoot as soon as the camera's out of the box, we end up using in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
we have to re-record.
We have no mic on him. We have no shotgun mic. It's just the built-in stereo mic in the camera across this really kind of cavernous hotel room.
Yes, bizarre.
So it sounds horrible.
It was very live.
And then
space.
To add to that, the fact that Dean's Canadian public school education was on full display.
Okay, to those who don't know, I said this was a 15-month argosy.
Okay.
Right?
So begins a 15-month argosy.
Right. The actual word is odyssey, because in the third grade, we had a book called The Argosy, which our teacher said, you know, it's a giant epic journey. When in fact, it's actually the boat you take on the giant epic journey.
You get on the Argosy to go on an odyssey.
Right.
It's a merchant
vessel.
Which
is Jason and the Argonauts exactly. Ride the Argosy to go on the odyssey right. With a disuse over to the... wherever they went. Anyway, the point is that Argosy and Odyssey are very close.
That's and true. Indeed, proven that they're close.
Yeah.
ADRing Odyssey for Argosy worked perfectly.
Perfectly. You would never know I screwed it up unless you listened to this podcast. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for bringing that up. Way to go.
But to help make it realistic, I did put the microphone way across the room.
Oh, you did? Yes. And open the door and let birds fly around and people parking their car right. Just outside the balcony window.
No. So one of the what stage of the process you get the sound when the film is edited together, when picture is locked.
I know. That's when it's supposed to happen.
Yeah, picture is supposed to be locked, meaning there won't be any more changes to picture.
Never happens.
But at the very least, you hope that there won't be any changes that affect the timeline.
Yeah, and that happens too. You know, you just have to roll with it. The problem is once it gets to sound, you know, all these, we have the file called the OMF file, which has the picture as cut with all the sound underneath. You know, it goes to different people. It goes to the Foley artist. It goes to the guy that's going to put together the ADR, dialogue editor, the effects guy, everything. And so if there's a change, it has to change across all those guys. And that could be a lot of work.
So how many guys actually do sound then on a film typically?
6 million.
No.
No. Let's see. You know, it changes from film to film. I got to be honest with you. And, you know, it depends on on budgets as well. But
what's the first step? What's the first step? When you get the film, the picture's locked. What's the first step in the process of creating the post-production sound?
Well, you try to get a couple things running at the same time. I like to start with dialogue because...
I thought that there was a spotting session.
Well, of course there's a spotting session.
But people who are listening don't know that.
I don't know what a spotting session is.
See? listening don't know, we mean Dean Hagler.
He doesn't know filmmaking process.
The guy listening, right? Well, it's sort of like an argosy. a spotting session is... spotting session, you know, you sit with the filmmakers, you talk about creative ideas and technical issues that they have for the film.
Right.
And, you know, you watch through the entire film, take notes, and then they go away. We do some of the creative and artistic and technical stuff. They come back, check on it, and, you know, record ADR, do all that stuff.
So then
the spotting session is really just talking it out. You know, what is it that they want to do? What's their vision? And how can we, through sound,
how do they see
support
sound?
That vision?
But is that vision already gone? I mean, haven't they already filmed it, put it in the can by that time?
Well, certainly, but you know, there are different ways you can approach a scene. You know, if it's a very subjective scene, if there's a lot of point of view, you know, will you just play it straight? You know, the sounds that the character is hearing from his point of view, will you just hear everything as it is, or is there something going on with this character that we make the sounds sound a little different, or there's a car going by that, you know, we push the sound of that a little bit because it's the important car. You know, what are you trying to do?
Well, yeah, and
how
where,
can you sell
where
the
is
drama
this location?
The
right, right.
Garrett might, you know, see a room that might be just a cavernous hotel room.
Right.
Right. But then we might want to say to him, look, it's very important for the purposes of things that happen later in the film that this hotel room is conveniently situated atop a freeway.
Right.
You know, for whatever reason, because later gunshots are going to ring out from the freeway.
Right, right.
And so we should probably establish that sound very early on.
Yeah. That makes sense.
A plot point.
Yeah.
A plot point.
Yeah.
There's like going to be a gun.
My vision is to emphasize plot points.
Well, and one thing sound-wise, Phil's second movie, The Party Crashers, was filmed in... what, two or three different locations, I think.
Well, yeah, there's an opening to the film and a close to the film, but the bulk of the movie itself takes place within a Hollywood party held hostage. And it was being shot, that whole sequence was being shot in a penthouse in Beverly Hills. And, you know, I mean, the bulk of our shoot was scheduled for that location. And I think the second day of shooting in that location,
they said get out.
Yeah, we lost
a ghostly presence.
We lost the location because the very sweet smelling, easy on the eyes Beverly Hills Police Department came by and said, "You've got people on a section on the roof for which you are not permitted. Extras were waiting."
They are the unsung heroes of the nation.
Yes. Extras or the Beverly Hills Police Department?
The police department, no doubt.
Anyway, and so. Yeah, so it was this wonderful thing where it was just this technicality, but they had to pull our permit and then said, but, you know, and I said, I understood. And, you know, they said, well, we think that you'll have no problem getting it reinstated, but you do have to go to City Hall, to the office to get it done.
Right.
I said, okay. And they said, oh, by the way, it's Friday, so they're closed today.
Awesome.
And when will they be open? Well, ordinarily they open on Monday, but Monday is a holiday.
Right.
So they'll be open on Tuesday.
Right.
Oh, so you mean our last day of shooting in this location, they'll be open again.
Yeah.
So that involved scrambling. And so we ended up finding, I think it was...
a basement.
Three other locations.
Wow. Oh, I didn't realize it was...
for this one location to cover different parts of this party in this penthouse apartment.
Yeah.
So that was four locations. And they, you know, I mean, so like at one point when a character is running, let's say, from the kitchen to... you know, the bedroom, that turned out to be a 40-mile run.
Wow.
And one of the things that then becomes really important, you know, we did certain things with lighting. The actors, God bless them, really seemed to know where they were going, so the geography made sense.
Right.
Cinematographer Matt Labatique had come up with a very interesting idea visually for transition spaces, so it would send you the subtle message that you knew where we were in the party based on this interesting lighting
right.
that he had designed. But a big part of it was, of course, the sound.
Right.
The sound had to make you believe that this was all one location and that you were hearing the pieces from the different rooms and you knew where they would be coming from and all that.
And that's a big part of dialogue editing is blending the back, you know, different rooms sound differently. They have different, whatever it is, hums, you know, the stuff you're trying to get rid of.
Because some actors hum a lot.
Yeah, I know. Well, I know. Especially after running 40 miles.
Oh, yeah. So do you do Foley sound as well? And you do
that's
all that?
That's right, yeah.
And so do you have... I have never seen a big thing.
You've been
of,
in there. You've been in the Foley room.
Yeah, yeah. We that's record the Foley AR
sandbox.
And Foley
so, I didn't see a sandbox
well,
in there.
Well, we cover it up, you know.
Oh.
So that you feel like you're at home.
Well, what's but, the... yeah. I mean, I guess we're into Foley now. What is Foley for
yeah,
people who don't know?
It's named after... some imaginary person.
No way.
Yeah.
I thought he was a real person.
I don't. Jack Foley? Doesn't that sound made up? I don't know. Anyway, there's the Monty ADR invented ADR. By the way. Not everybody knows that. It's another little tidbit for you. But Foley is create. You want to create. There are three parts to it. There's footsteps, cloth, and props. And so the first thing you do is you go through, and every time somebody moves, you're making a noise with some kind of thing, depending on what they're wearing, if it's cotton or if it's sequins or whatever. So you're following their movements. And sequins. Then, yeah, you don't have to wear it. You just...
you can just rattle it.
You rub it together, yeah.
Okay.
And then next you do footsteps. You know, you got tons of different shoes and different surfaces that are in there. And then after that are the props, anything that an actor handles, picks up, or puts down. And then, as well, any sound design. There was a movie we worked on that had a monster in it, and he's like stomping through the forest, and so you know, the guy tied telephone books to his feet and was stomping around in mud in there as a layer of what was going to be.
Oh, cool!
So there, and you know, that's sort of the designy stuff, and that's where it gets a little bit fun.
Right.
Yeah.
And I heard when they did Godzilla, the remake,
right.
They couldn't match the original Godzilla sound, so they just resampled it off an old 50s movie and stuck it in there.
Yeah.
Is that really hard to do, is match like old monster sounds? Like doing monsters, now that you mentioned it, I would think is really difficult.
Yeah. A lot of people start with animals and, you know, slow them down or speed them up. You know, starts with like a pig squeal and it becomes a velociraptor or whatever.
And would the reason that it would be so hard to match it be because of how it was recorded back in the day?
'50s?
Yeah. In that sense, I don't know. Maybe they were just trying to recapture, you know, the nostalgia of it. And, you know,
because Godzilla sounded pretty specific.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that would be the concern.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe they it's just too sophisticated now. But no, I think, you know, they do that. They restore a lot of those old sounds. And in fact, I think in every one of Spielberg's movie, there's a King Kong roar in it somewhere.
Is that right?
It's buried in the sound design. Maybe not every one of them, but like when Jaws.
I loved it in Color Purple.
Yeah, I know. That was my favorite
and
one.
And always? Yeah. That was awesome.
But like when Jaws is sinking down to the bottom of the ocean, you hear this little kind of roar in the background.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, listen for it next time.
I'm going to listen for it.
Yeah. Like I think it was Indiana Jones's hat too. So I don't know.
That sounded like King Kong.
Yeah, it was something weird like
his
that.
Hat.
Nah, it doesn't.
He's got nothing.
I got nothing.
So when you have this, okay. We've talked a little bit about Foley. What's the first step in the process after the spotting session?
Well, that would be dialogue and ADR. You want to start on the dialogue, see what you can save, see what alternate takes you may have that'll work. And make your ADR list and send those back to the filmmaker so he can alert the actors' agents or the actors directly about the ADR schedule.
Now, ADR has become, it seems to me, much easier and much more performance-friendly through the advent of digital technology.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I remember, you know, even when I was in film school, when you still had to synchronize the reels of the magnetic film that things were being recorded on, boy, there was a lot less flexibility for an actor, and it was a lot more kind of stressful.
I would think
the environment, because you know you really had to hit it. Whereas now you very much have the ability to, like, I've had to do some ADR, and as you've always pointed out, right? Like, I can match it, but I'm always a consistent amount fast. Because
I
just can't figure out the beeps.
Right.
So I'm always starting early. And I'm this way in karaoke, too, in singing. I'm always the same amount ahead throughout the whole song. But it's consistent. So if I had a sound engineer there,
he could
recording
slide
my karaoke rendition of Centerfold by Jay Giles Band, then they could just slide it back and it would fit into place perfectly.
Right.
Wow.
They could do that
instead
in
of me trying to lead the orchestra.
So you can't follow the little lighted letters as they light from change from color to white from pink or whatever.
Wouldn't that be great if that's how ADR was done?
Yeah, wouldn't it be? So, it's like karaoke.
It's become, it seems, a much more fun process. And
well, for some people, I think a lot of that stress was just something that actors can carry in there with them sometimes. And
is this
a
holdover from the 1927?
Yeah, because all actors that come in here are 90 years old. I hate doing ADR.
But the microphone changed my career.
Well, I think that some actors...
the advent of sound, right?
I think that some actors, believe it or not, maybe forget... And some great actors hate doing ADR.
Yeah.
Some great actors are unbelievably brilliant at ADR.
Can change a performance.
Robert Duvall comes to mind as one of these guys who is really brilliant. But I think part of it is that it's easy to forget that it is acting.
Yeah.
It still is acting.
Well, it's a little more mechanical first. It's like you got to count 1, 2, 3, right. Act.
Yeah. You've got to learn how to count off.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to count before acting.
Well, you do have to have rhythm. And
it's a new.
Not everybody does.
Well, it's a new dance step. Is really what you're figuring out, and so that's why it becomes problematic. But sometimes it's they get really wrapped up in. My experience is just that it's very easy to get wrapped up in the technical requirements of it instead of appreciating that even if they can't match it themselves perfectly,
right?
Because I've seen this enough that you've done this now. That even if they can't match it perfectly in terms of the timing, simply getting a clean recording of it is still so much better than what we might have had.
Sure. And
that you can do a lot with it to then make it fit.
Yeah, the tools for editing it now have improved greatly over the last several years. So,
but
you
it's really...
You can stretch out a syllable to make it fit. You know, there's software.
You can stretch out the syllable itself?
Yeah.
You're kidding.
Yeah, well, you can cut down to, you know... Tiniest little.
Remember
bit of
how
a frame?
We were trying to solve my bad dissolve in Out There with an audio fix because my dissolve hadn't worked so that I wouldn't have to go and redo the dissolve, which could potentially have been problematic in terms of the timeline. And he did that by stretching out a couple of words that people were saying. To change the emphasis.
Change the emphasis. Yeah, that's right, too.
Wow. But one of the things that I remember with AD, I remember a lot about this particular ADR session, but when we had Marina Sirtis from Star Trek The Next Generation in for Spectres, but there was one line reading that we needed to get, and she was really troubled because she couldn't recapture how it sounds. So it really, it you could hear it, it fit. Timing-wise, it fit.
Right.
But there was, but she was troubled performance-wise by the fact that it really, it felt out of context.
Uh-huh.
She could not make it, no matter how much of lead that we heard, no matter how much other lines we let her say, she couldn't get it back in. And then I looked in to see what she was doing, and I think I said to stand up or to sit down, whichever, the opposite of whatever she was doing, because, you know, we see on screen that she's standing up.
Right.
Right.
And then as soon as she stood up, it fit perfectly.
Ah, right.
And it's, as an actor on a set, of course you appreciate how much your physical embodiment affects a line reading.
Yeah. Sure.
You can forget that when you're in a closed-off booth with headphones on, staring at a monitor, worrying about getting the timing right.
You're not really in the moment, and it can be hard to transport yourself. And really, I feel like our job out here, when we're talking to them over the headphones, they're hearing our disembodied voices in their heads saying, no, it's too fast, you know, or whatever, is to just, you know, make them as comfortable and give them an opportunity to, as comfortable as possible, give them an opportunity to get back in the scene.
But here's the thing, though, is that it is still acting. Because what we just described about the having to block all those things out and create for yourself that moment again, well, increasingly on the set of films and television shows, it's exactly what the actor has to. You're in a body stocking with blue dots on your face.
And you're in a green room.
You're
being held by a giant spaceship.
Now, can you cry about what your father did?
I was surprised how much green screen was used in The Truth Is Out There, honestly.
We had to put a lot in there. Now, we had David Soboloff, who's a master voiceover guy, and he says now a lot of sound technicians use the phrase "leave a lung on the glass."
In the glass.
In the glass. No, I thought it was on the glass.
No, I thought it was a lung in the glass job.
No, it's like you've screamed so much you left your lung on the glass.
Oh, on the glass of the window.
Between the studio and the thing. Have you ever said that to anyone?
No, I think that's another 20s term.
That's a 20s term.
No, I think it's a video game term.
I think it's a video game term. You don't do video games,
you hear it, RocketWorks.
I've done a couple, but nothing huge. You know?
Right.
Like not by preference, but what... break down for us a little bit the percentage of the kind of jobs that you get here.
Well, it's primarily independent feature films. Mm-hmm. We've had a fair share of documentaries, but it's, you know, mostly just the features, the fiction pieces.
Right. Pornography.
That's right. Top of the list right there. I chase that stuff down.
Those ADR sessions can go on forever.
Ever. Oh, my God.
Do it again.
The only one where I wear
cameras. And do it again.
So the... That.
And they all involved Dean Haglund.
What? I don't know.
I knew him long before. So that, and you know, as well as trailers, commercials, we've done a couple of TV shows that have been a lot of fun to work on.
Right.
And you know, just the every project, every show is different, and is a chance to be creative in a different way, and it's just a blast.
Well, now the first, in fact, the partner with which you with whom you founded RocketWorks,
Jesse,
RocketWorks was involved in the production of a television series, was it not?
That's correct. Yeah, American Fighter Pilot. That was
American
on CBS.
Fighter Pilot.
It was, again, I feel like we're really pushing the docs, but, you know, those are the ones that have won awards, actually.
Yeah.
But American Fighter Pilot, AFP, was on CBS Friday nights. I think it was around the time of Walker, Texas Ranger, or something like that.
I missed this.
So, it was kind of a blip on the radar, unfortunately. CBS ended up canceling it after a couple episodes, but we did all of the episodes.
Oh.
And they're selling really well on DVD.
It was, and so they go and interview American fighter pilots?
Well, it was started out as Jesse just had gotten one of the first high-def cameras off, you know, right off the assembly line, followed a group of fighter pilots through the Top Gun training program.
Oh, cool.
At Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida. That's in Panama City Beach in Florida, in the Panhandle.
Yeah, yeah.
And in order to do this properly, he went through some of the Top Gun training as well, so that he could go up in the jets with them and film. So, you know, he's getting, you know, thrown in the big drum, you know, down into the giant pool and blindfolded and having to find his way, you know, all that crazy training, the centrifuge, everything.
Oh, cool.
And but he ends up going up there, and you know, his first experience having that high def camera, the pilot's up there flipping switches, you know, moving his arms around. Jesse's arms are just like glued to the thing. And he's like, "All right, I'm gonna pick up the camera and film now." He picks it up, and all you see the footage is just whoop, just whaps to the side, and it's like a shot of the canopy for a little while. But he got to where, I mean, he was just like bulked up, and
because the G forces, because he's around. Fighting G forces, and he's got a giant heavy.
Yeah.
Bet the first ones were heavy as hell. Those cameras,
but he got some incredible footage, and that's why Tony Scott got involved in the show. He was amazed by what Jesse had shot and had edited together. And that's when it became not just this documentary my buddy was working on, but something that was going to be on television. And then it went to CBS and became a series. So
now,
it's a lot of fun.
You know,
a lot
of things,
sound design in that one, too.
I bet.
One of the things I'm fond of saying is that sound ruined movies.
Yeah, of course.
The old Orson Welles comment, that sound ruined
movies. That's on my website, yeah. I try to push that point.
And, of course, there was a real point to this, which was, you know, they had the art of cinematic storytelling had been perfected in the silent era.
Yes.
Right.
And then the advent of sound rendered all of that moot, and everybody had to start over again.
Right.
In fact, with films that were far less visually interesting than, like, the original Great Train Robbery.
True. And also made movie production expenses through the roof.
Expenses, everything became so difficult, it became less visually interesting than seeing a stage play.
Yeah.
Really, because at least at a stage play, you can turn your head. Right? Whereas on screen, they couldn't even turn the camera because they had to build it into these locked rooms. And
so you couldn't hear the camera.
So they really had to start over, and they had to redesign equipment, and they had to everything.
And Jack Gilbert was a big major star, and then his voice was so
nasally. But it took almost a decade for visual storytelling to recover from the advent of sound.
Yeah.
You watch even the really good movies from the 30s, and many of them are little more than film stage plays,
in a sense.
Yeah.
But now, really, at a time when, thank heavens, the means to make movies and even to show movies is becoming far more democratic and something that many more storytellers have access to, I find again that quite often sound ruins movies.
Well, that's true.
Because
right?
One of the things in which people are most likely to be uneducated and they're, you know, and certainly unpracticed in is sound.
Yeah.
And directors, you know,
will have great visual ideas.
They might, or they're a really good story, work with actors, whatever, and producers, no background in sound whatsoever. And I feel like it's the place most likely where you cut costs.
Yeah.
And since nobody knows,
no, that's not true.
Nobody knows what they're doing.
Nobody,
ends up happening is a surprising amount of films.
Case in point, Robert Rodriguez, his first film, that Assassins thing, where he shot in Mexico,
El Mariachi.
Once they distributed it, they had to give him $100,000 just to fix the sound. They said, "Don't edit a thing; just make it so." That
right, like that. The rumor about it costing $7,000 to make.
Yeah,
but but then they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars fixing the
sound. Yeah.
So it really wasn't $7,000. He made a $7,000 film. They released a much more expensive.
Yeah.
Film.
Well, I think the point is $7,000 film got him a career.
Exactly.
Right.
But I say this because I can't stress enough how many times, you know, and I love going to film festivals and I love seeing all sorts of movies, and there are so many films where, you know, Jesus, if they just spent money, people I know who won't spend any money on sound,
right?
And they're relegating their films to a certain level of acceptance, period, and it's never going to go beyond that.
Yeah, you're right.
Because it has to be people in the audience who are willing to put in the work to go beyond the fact that the sound is taking you out of the reality all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is this incredibly complicated aspect of filmmaking where it might have to be completely manufactured, but what you're manufacturing is the reality that you're hoping to sell to the audience.
Exactly, yeah. Well, that's part of the reason, you know, we started the company was, you know, I had friends, I started out at a PA in Roger Corman's company down, yeah, Concord New Horizons,
oh,
and it was over there on Main Street in Venice. And, you know, cleaning fake blood off the floor was my first job. Like, here's a rag. But a lot of my friends there, you know, went on to make some movies. And I saw some of these at festivals, and they sounded just horrible. And it was something that really stood out. And, you know, the choices at the time were, you know, a guy in his garage or, you know, the giant.
That was my first film.
Yeah, that was the name of your first film.
Guy in the garage.
Yeah, or the a giant company, you know, that was going to give them a break on the price, and then after exactly 8 hours, show them the door.
Well, so, yeah, that's it. It's in sound, you truly do get what you pay for.
Yeah,
that was historically it. You get what you pay for. You get a guy in the garage, or you get a big company that's doing you a favor.
Right.
But you almost don't want that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because and
they're
not only the 8 hours, I mean, also. You're working into their schedule too. You can get bumped at any time,
right?
And
he's sort of blown it off because he's got other gigs.
And you know, some films have been really well served that way. I think that you know became pet projects, excuse me, of the owners or whatever. But in this instance, you know, I was just seeing a lot of fails, and I thought, you know, the idea behind this was to create a boutique company that could keep the costs lower and get the filmmakers what they wanted creatively and quality-wise.
Right.
So, you know, it was something that the equipment, the digital audio workstations were really coming into something of their own. You know, Pro Tools had been around for a while, but it was mostly used for music. And when we started, we used the Fairlight digital audio workstation,
right.
You may remember. We used that on Party Crashers was the first film
the
we
first
worked
film
on.
The first film here in Rocketworks.
In 1997.
Wow. In this facility.
That did Fairlight Audio Tools? I didn't know what Fairlight was. Is that an early precursor to Pro Tools?
It's its own box. It was a digital audio workstation. It wasn't software. It was all hardware.
Oh, wow.
The console, there were parts in that were only found elsewhere, like in an FA-18 jet or something like that. It was really solid. And, I loved it. However... you know, they
technology's moved on.
Yeah,
how much are you chasing technology in this room?
You know, Pro Tools is pretty solid now,
right?
So it's just a matter of, you know, keeping up to date on software updates. And the thing is, it used to be, all right, now we need another card, we need another this and that. Now Pro Tools is becoming, you need less and less.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah,
they're shrinking their footprint.
They're basically doing more within the box. So it's pretty amazing. This has been a more recent development with them, but really cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Now, how many features roughly would you say have come through Rocketworks here, boutique shop, in the going on 14 years?
14 years.
Wow.
Try not to hit my microphone.
Yeah.
I do that. As you've seen in the film, yeah. I do this.
That's what you do.
I gesture and hit microphones, and then you have to go and somehow... managed to
we're gonna let that
to take
stay,
out the microphone hit because I refuse to do ADR or karaoke. How many features would you say roughly have come through here?
You know what, I'm not exactly sure. You know, I stopped counting after a while, but you know, on the IMDb, you know, that only represents a portion of the stuff we've actually worked on. I think I've got 40 to 50 features that are on there.
Wow.
And are you pleased with the return? I mean, how would I put this? But the repeat business? I mean, do you find that
people come back?
That filmmakers come back? Are you pleased by the...
Oh, absolutely, of course. You know, the thing is, I enjoy it, and I feel like, you know, we're all doing something together, sitting around, actually having a good time. sitting in a room being creative. Right. You know, sound is kind of like that's the point where you can kind of be a little more laid back. You know, I've had people come to me and say, oh, man, with this filmmaker, when this director comes in, he was such a terror on the set. You're going to hate it. You're going to hate it. And I've had the best time, you know, because it's just the nature of, I think part of it is the nature of the room and,
right.
and so forth. But it's also, you know, what it is that you're doing. You know, of course, there is a time element. There's a schedule. There's a constraint. But it's just you're sitting back, relaxing, creating, coming up with ideas. And the software as well has made it easier to try out different things a lot more quickly than, you know, you were talking about how ADR has come along.
Right.
You know, imagine sound design. Well, we want to take this gunshot, reverse it, stretch it out. And, no, that's not working. All right, let's try the next thing.
Right.
Yeah, whatever it is to try to create that environment.
Huh.
I think a big part of it though is also you, Garrett, because no, it is true. I'm not making up this stereotype of sound engineers and sound mixers and sound
you're not
recorders.
Making that up. You're just
as a group. I'm. I'll be honest. Directors. And actors,
yep.
and many people who spend their lives on sets and making movies
right.
will talk among themselves about people who are no damn fun to work with, who really hurt the atmosphere on a set. And more often than not, we're talking about people in the sound department.
Oh.
There's a lot
yeah.
of people in the sound department who don't have the best people skills that are not particularly fun.
Right.
For what I don't, you know, again, it's a stereotype. I'm, you know, whatever.
Life and headphones.
But I have had many experiences with sound people, both in on the set and in post-production. Not the best.
Right.
Experiences, not fun.
Sure.
Rocketworks, you may use this on your business. Rocketworks, where fun happens.
Done and done, sir.
No, and you know, it is funny. People, I don't think, realize this because L.A. is kind of a small town, and you do bump into people around campus all the time. But for the most part, if we want to get to hang out with our friends, we make movies.
Right.
That's what we do. We make movies yeah. kind of to hang out with our friends. I mean, that's
right.
That is part of an aspect
true.
Of it, yeah. you know?
That's why it's hard to break into, like, comedy writing, because you're not going to get on a comedy show just because you're a funny writer, because you're going to be hanging around with a guy at 4 a.m., he's going to hang around with his friends who are comedy writers
right.
as opposed to some stranger who sent in something funny
yeah.
who they have no idea what it's like to hang around with that guy.
Well, that's exactly it. It's long hours. It's hard work. There are serious pressures involved
yeah.
in it.
Stress.
And so you want it to be fun.
Right.
And
so why are we doing this?
Why do we still do the podcast together? Part of our work furlough release
I know.
Rules.
Eight more shows and I've done my community hours.
Nice.
But
I'm
it's
so
true.
Happy I could be a part of this.
I mean, this is our fourth feature together, yes?
Yeah.
Fourth
really?
Feature together, yeah.
Spectres, Party Crashers. What's
first one was Party Crashers. Rocketworks did not exist, sadly, when I did my first film. The whole experience might have turned out much, much different.
Yeah.
Especially if he could have figured out how to digitally replace the lead actress.
Oh.
And that's...
With the voice of Sean Connery.
I can say that only because... You got me to talk about that while I was drunk in a pub on our fourth anniversary show.
People who had a find
third
that
anniversary show.
Show
third,
third
anniversary,
anniversary
show.
Show.
But anyway.
You could download that show.
He was drunk.
Spectres. Yeah. Carl Rove, I love
Karl
you.
Rove.
Karl Rove, I love
and
you.
Now,
of course.
And now, of course, the truth,
the
is,
truth
out
is out there.
And there will be many, many more.
That's awesome.
Let me ask you, I want to get into some fun stories. But
yes, name
but,
dropping.
But
for meta tags.
The last serious kind of question.
Right.
Now, having been at this, in this, running this boutique shop for 14 years, is there something or some things that you consistently beat your head against that are the most frustrating?
Drives you nuts with indie makers.
Of running this particular business, doing this particular work?
Maybe of a technical nature, you know.
I mean, you mentioned a little bit about how, you know, the discussion of having to chase the technology a little bit. But is there something where you still, after 14 years, are going, you know, I wish either I could somehow convince people to come in earlier on the projects, or I wish, or is there a problem that you yourself have yet to figure out a consistent solution to.
Besides the Rubik's Cube, I wish filmmakers a lot of times would think a little more about sound before even shooting the film. And, you know, it's nothing that necessarily has to cost any money, just a little bit of education on thinking about, you know, there are technical aspects and creative aspects. There are problems that we've solved, you know, with sound in bringing a plot point together, you know, just by having an off-screen actor ADR a line or something like that. Simple, simple little things.
Field of Dreams.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
Right?
I did not work on that, but yes.
Yeah, let's...
I did the company.
I thought that was the most famous story of ADR saving a movie.
But you may be correct.
I don't know.
But a lot of times, you know, I'll receive elements that are just technically not right. And so I just wish, you know, gosh, now they have to go back 2-3 steps, and it's going to be a lot of work to get them something that's going to work with sound so that they can marry it back to picture. So, you know, it's just, you really got to look ahead, because the technology, while it has come a long way, it's thrown a few monkey wrenches in as well. You know, yeah, you talk about time code, sampling rate, bit rates, all those things. Things have to match. And a lot of times, you know, they don't. And so we all end up having to pay for it with time.
Now, what about in terms of scheduling? How often when a film comes in do you find yourself facing an unrealistic and yet absolutely
crazy,
you know, really important deadline?
Well, you know what? It's that's really less often than it used to be.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I think.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, yeah. It's something that, you know, you get a couple of things going at once. You know, I can do backgrounds and effects while we're doing dialogue and ADR. You know,
look at that.
Just kind of scoot ahead. You know, you figure out the schedule over time. And it's been 14 years, and people come to me and say, I only have this much money and this much time. I'm like, all right, we'll find a way to make it work.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we've said this before on the show, but I think it bears repeating that in independent film, especially if you want to keep costs down, what you try to do is you try to do the official pre-production. You spend as much time as you can prepping it, but once pre-production begins, i.e. you're now paying people, you're on the clock, make pre-production and shooting as streamlined and as fast as possible, because that's what will save you costs. When you get into post-production, take as much time as you actually can.
Right.
Because you might not save money, but your money will go farther.
It'll go a hell
it will
farther.
Buy you so much more.
Right.
If you can
and
take as much
so
time
so many mistakes
possible.
That'll come on the day and all that sort
absolutely.
Of thing before, on the thing before. Fantastic. So now
some fun stories.
Fun stories.
I know that some very
who's the biggest name that ever been through these
Christopher
walls?
Lambert.
Christopher Lambert.
Well, that's
he's Highlander. Been in here. The had, Highlander.
Sally Field was here.
What?
Yeah, that's.
Did you like her? Did you really
young
really
Sally
like her?
Field or old?
You know what? She she always kind of. I didn't say this, but she reminded me of my mom when I was growing up. They kind of looked the same. They're both, you know, short and spunky and all that.
And where did you grow up? Shout out to
Dothan, Alabama.
Alabama. Where is that? A small town.
And when?
Yes.
Did you go to film school?
Yeah, Florida State.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you came out here,
the first graduating class from Florida State.
Did you do sound work?
Did you say Gainesville? Yes. How dare you, sir?
Isn't that Florida State?
No, that's the University of Florida. Florida State's in Tallahassee.
Did you do sound work?
Bitter rivals.
In college.
What's that?
Did you do sound work in college?
Oh, no. Not, I, you
so
know,
how
some.
Did you learn this?
You know, on the job training, really.
At Corman?
No.
But, yeah.
You know, I told you about that Fairlight digital audio workstation. It was brand new when we started, so I didn't know anything about that. You know, after I'd worked at Corman's, I was a post-production supervisor for a period of time, and that's covering every... In fact, I worked for a producer where we were doing everything from... you know, script development all the way to distribution. So everything in between, development to distribution, the two Ds. And so I knew the process, and I knew people, and I could interact with them. And then I thought, if I'm doing this with Jesse, if we're going to go out and strike out on our own, you know, we're going to have to, like, make that into something more specific. And so I just played, you know, got the machine out, pressed every button on it until I figured out what it did. basically. But I went on. I'm serious.
That's how I do all my software.
Yeah, that's how I learned to use a phone.
I mean, I might think that I knew how to edit in Final Cut when I started this project. Now I really do know.
Yeah,
because it isn't until you get to the point where, wait a minute, this won't let me do what I need to do.
Right.
Well, it has to. It has to. So then you start figuring out how to change it so that it will do what you need it to make it.
And we had the advantage going in. The reason I'm saying this is I don't recommend this to everybody as a way to learn something. It would probably be good to take a class or something. But we had the advantage of having some technical idea of what we were doing going in.
Right.
So, you know something about time code. You know something about all these elements, HD versus DV versus film, whatever it's going to be.
But the point is that you can learn it.
Yeah, yeah.
You can learn it, and you can learn by doing. So, all these famous people that have come through here, do you have any particularly favorite experiences with any of your celebrity guests here at Rocketworks?
There was one time. When we go back to the Christopher Lambert, the director on that show wanted to smoke in the studio. Now, this is not a big space, and it's just, it's a European thing, I get it, whatever, or New Zealand thing, I guess. But, I had to ask him several times, open up the door and say, I'm sorry, we can't let you smoke. This is an entire building as well. There are other people that are in here.
In Santa Monica, for crying out loud.
Yeah, you can't smoke on capital the promenade.
Yeah, I know.
So he stamped him out. Anyway, a couple of years later, there was a skateboarding documentary, and it was being narrated by Dennis Hopper. And I had just bought a new rug to put down in the Foley room to cover up the pits. And Dennis Hopper comes in, lights up a cigar, and I'm like, go for it, buddy. That's fine by me. I say, for the longest time, I had his ash, that ash from the cigar. Yeah. I still took pictures of it.
I was mistaken. I thought those were Dennis Hopper's ashes.
Dennis Hopper's ashes.
Too soon? Right?
Too soon. Okay, Dennis Hopper, Sally Field, Christopher Lambert.
Yeah.
Those are big names.
Well, I actually was hoping, I see that somebody has just come in who maybe can help me because we're at the time of the show where I need to talk about our sponsor. Okay. And I was hoping that maybe Sir Sean Connery could help me talk about the sponsor of the show.
I'm going to have to warm up.
Get him to warm up.
There are places I'll remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone. And some remain with the Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
There's no the.
Have you tried?
Sean?
I don't care.
That's great,
there is
Sean.
Now. There is now a the.
Mr. Connery, may I call you Sean?
Yes.
The show every week is brought to listeners around the world by the fabulous invention, the Chill Pack.
Oh, yes. I use it. Scotch.
It's made for the laptop. It's a
I
laptop.
Don't care.
Does it keep your scotch cool?
Oh, yes. And it runs faster down my throat.
Well, I guess also with the condensation-proof sleeve,
right?
It probably prevents the glass from perspiring.
I don't notice. I'm too drunk.
Do you have a laptop computer, Mr. Connery?
My assistant does have one of those play games thing. Yes.
Well, it keeps your laptop computer running fast and increases the longevity by keeping it cool. Uh-huh. It draws heat away from the CPU.
Well, that sounds innovative. What does innovative mean?
Of innovation.
Oh, yes, like that.
Yeah. People can find, such as yourself, can find a Chill Pack for themselves. It's environmentally friendly, it's easy to use, and it's easily affordable. You can find it at chillpack.com, chillpak.com.
Well, several things are easily affordable for me. You don't need to tell me that, sir. How dare you?
Sorry, Mr. Connery.
Are you an avid listener of Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, Mr. Connery?
I think sometimes someone leaves it on in the background.
Well, that's how we get a lot
of our listeners.
Yes,
yeah.
That's where
and many of them become likers of the show on Facebook. Are you on Facebook?
Yes, I am.
What's your profile page?
It's what do you mean?
Facebook.com/
How do they find you?
/ the guitarist. I partied with him one time.
We kept our drinks cold on the guitarist.
The guitarist.
People can like this show.
What are you talking about?
on Facebook. Facebook.com/ChillPackHollywoodHour
Chill Pack Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
Dear God.
That open container of paint thinner next door. You know, I always joke about how I have an open container of paint thinner when we're doing this show.
Yeah.
One day, Garrett and I were in here doing the mix, and, you know, we became aware of a cleaner smell. And then later, it turns out we find out that what we've been inhaling all afternoon is paint thinner from next door.
That's awesome.
And that night, I'm up laughing my ass off because I realized how high we were. Because, of course, I thought during the day that my bongo solo was the perfect fix to an audio problem in the film.
So awesome.
Oh, I was behind it 100%.
Dude, that totally did it.
People can also become friends of the show MySpace, myspace.com/ChillPackHollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we're at ChillPackHollywood.com. I think we've mentioned everything else. Does RocketWorks have a website? Mr. Connery, if you were to visit RocketWorks, could you find them on the web?
Yes, I could. Oh, there's more to it. at RocketWorks.com. RocketWorks, WERKS.com.
Thank you very much, Mr. Connery.
Thank you.
We appreciate you being on our show ever so briefly.
And thanks to Garrett Watley.
Thank you, guys.
Yay. I appreciate it.
And to RocketWorks. Now get back to work on our film.
Yeah.
Hurry up.
Let's do it. Thanks.
See you next week.
Thanks, guys.